Joseph Chilton Pierce has been cited as one of the great chroniclers of our cultural insanity, and I would add that in order to do this well, he's had to see right through it, which he does, and his 12 books are some of our best contemporary writings, which share insights and understanding to the nth degree. Joe's latest book is Exploring the Crack in the Cosmic Egg, Split Minds and Meta Realities. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Joseph, I think it would be a great place to start with a research project that you relate that was done by Charles Tart. And this is an experiment where a subject sat in a soundproofed room designed for sensory deprivation studies. The subject was wired up for brainwave recordings, skin resistance, heart rate, muscular activity, and respiratory changes, and all recorded on the polygraph machine. And then down the hall, in a similar chamber, an agent or sender was electrically shocked at random intervals. And the subject was asked to guess when the sender was being shocked. The subject's polygraph reading indicated significant physiological changes at those instants when the agent was randomly shocked. But the subject's conscious guesses at when the shocks occurred showed no relation to the actual events as recorded by his polygraph readings. So the schism starts.
Well, great guns. I hadn't thought about that particular aspect in a long time. The whole thing about that is that mind is can be absolutely independent of the brain that produces it. And as a result, we can pick up information far removed from our physical premise. That's about what that was about. In fact, I find the very same premise being explored right in my neighbor next to me, the Monroe Institute. And they do essentially that same thing. They really are, it's quite an exceptional place. The discovery is simply that, and certainly a brain produces a mind, but the mind at a certain point becomes independent of the brain that produces it. Now that's really what that's all about. And as a result, mind can then pick up information on a vastly wider scale than can be approached physically. And a lot of our problems in communication are simply that we fail to recognize that communication takes place on a very wide level. One of the things I was most fascinated with was how this is true in nature and the extent to which it's true in nature, and how in nature animals will communicate with each other on levels that leave us completely out of the picture. I might have even, I don't know if I did quote this in one of our books, but on this very issue of mind being independent of the brain, which it must have to be produced. It's sort of like a child growing up, they've got to have that parent at a certain point. They certainly need to be independent of it. But the same thing with all of nature. I used, for instance, the fact that an ant heap, and this is, I think, one of the most fascinating things I've run across, an ant heap with all those little ants running in every direction and rubbing their feelers up against it, passing information about source of food and so forth. Very, very busy things. They found that without a queen ant, the hive won't function at all. They researchers took the queen ant from an ant heap like that out of the nest, and nothing happened. They went right on, busy as they could be, bringing in all their chow and everything else, and they started moving the queen ant further and further away, and they finally had moved the queen ant hundreds of yards away and hadn't made the least bit of difference. The little critters went right ahead doing their job and storing up their chow and so on. But then they killed the queen ant, at which point instantly all work stopped. And that ant group was defunct right at that very, very point. And to me, that we think in this day of worship of particles, physics as kind of a religion, and it's not true at all, it's not anything to depend on, we think that there has to be some kind of particle contact for these things to work. It's not the case at all. And I think this business about the ants was a good example. There's no particle contact, and yet tremendous information and communication is expanded over a wide area without any physical contact at all. And I think this is true on the human level. An awful lot of the problems we have as a society today is that we pick up everything that's going on, whether it's intended for us or not. And the current situation we have with our living Earth itself is in shambles, in a great deal of trouble, simply because we've failed to recognize the nature of communication itself.
Well, I think, as you spoke a little bit about that research project where the person that was asked to recognize when there was a stimulation with the other person, their actual conscious awareness of it happened at a slower pace as they were also hooked up to these electrodes. Their electrode reaction, which was more of an unconscious reaction, happened right at the time, and yet there, when they pushed the button, when they felt like something was going on, there was like a time delay. And I think a lot of what you're speaking about, and correct me if I'm wrong, in your latest book, Exploring the Crack in the Cosmic Egg, is about how our culture helps to force this pseudo-reality and the split, which just has enormous ramifications as far as how we are as human beings.
Oh, indeed. I got to thinking of the problems we're facing with the issue of global warming, for instance, which affects everybody. And on many, many different levels that have not as yet been accepted at all, simply from not just economic, but political reasons. And when I've been fascinated with this issue of global warming because everything we're doing in regard to that, none of that fails to take into consideration that the Earth is a living globe. It's a living structure. I'm sure you've heard me talk about it. In 1925, they set up a research center in England two Scottish physicians by the name of Williamson and Pierce were head of it and doing some of the most brilliant research that's ever been done. And they, to cut to the quick here, what they discovered and were publishing on by 1930 was that the Earth was a living entity. It was an intelligent growth process. And excuse me, and that our actions on Earth had a profound effect on Earth itself in ways that we were not aware of. And I just recently was reading again about this business of global warming, and we've missed the point entirely on that because we're all caught up in this particle physics belief that seemed to work pretty well maybe in the last century, but it's really failing us seriously in this. The Earth is a living globe. It's an intelligent process and moves to try to protect itself from extremes. Now, certainly, we mine the Earth, we pump oil out of it, and we do all these things to it. And so far, I've gotten away with a great deal of that. But some of the things now happening, the Earth is literally, you can say, rebelling against. And in that case, I think the real truth of what is involved in global warming can be found. And we're getting into a real serious bind as a people, as an intelligent people.
Yes, and I think as you write quite in depth the denial of beingness, it seems like every culture has that denial, and whether it's translated into peer pressures or...
Well, I think from my standpoint, our culture is in real deep problems from failure to recognize the Earth as for what it really is. We've always done strange things with the Earth, but nothing to the extent of today. I was just reading, I believe it was in the New Atlantic or one of those magazines, of the stunning, incredible amount of coal being mined and burned. Something we're talking about, millions of tons a day. I didn't know there was that much coal in the whole world.
Yes.
And it said that a great deal of it is coming from the Appalachian Mountains. Not all of it by a long shot, but a great deal from there. And then I recalled a statement in one of the science magazines that the greatest damage that's ever been done to the Earth is occurring right now in the Appalachian Mountains through strip mining. And as you know, strip mining can level whole mountain ranges. I was born and bred right in the middle of them in Southwest Virginia. And my brother and I went up on one of our favorite lookout points a few years ago and looked out at what used to be range after range after range for as far as I could see of beautiful green mountains. Now you saw plateau country like looking like Arizona or New Mexico as they've obliterated literally the tops of mountain range after range after range. And it said the greatest threat to the Earth itself is happening right now in front of us and largely in our own southern mountains. Well, I say go down to the southern mountains and look, and it's all over the place, you see. And so these are failures to recognize the full extent of the damage we're doing, because we're doing that damage to a highly intelligent living globe and not just a chunk of rock that we can do anything we take a notion to.
Yes, and yet I really appreciated when I was reading in your book that you said, I'm not suggesting a back-to-nature romantic revolt. Nature, as you refer to it, is our natural given state of communion. And this is something we need to get with, isn't it? Because everything else will certainly flow from it. And depending on whether we are having that connection will dictate what we will do.
There are two books that have come up recently that are so incredibly important. I think I'm already starting to get out on the corners of a city and starting to try to peddle them. Original Wisdom by a writer by the name of Robert Wolff. He's written a lot of other things, and he's a very old man now, and he lived for many years with the Malaysian a group in the Malaysian jungles. He was trained as a psychiatrist and psychologist in Holland, and then went down there to work for the government, and found, just by being there so long, discovered a group of people that was only a myth in most people's minds, called the Signoi, and they lived in perfect, complete harmony with their environment. And Wolf found that going through the Malaysian jungles with them, he literally found a different jungle than he did without them, that their presence changed the very environment as they worked and lived through it. And yet, one of us who are not blessed with that kind of sight come in and we find the same old mess. So this then brought to mind the business of the Australian Aborigine, that when Cook first hit that continent, there were an estimated 500,000 Aborigine. Today there are maybe 5,000 left, and all the rest have simply died because we've destroyed their earth right out from under them. And I had the great privilege of talking at great length with a lady who had come back from 9 years traveling with the Australian Aborigine. They had adopted her into their totem, and she'd gone through their adoption ceremonies and all, and had traveled with them for 9 years, then had to leave because her health broke. And she ended up at an ashram where I happened to be living over in India at the time. Then what she had to say was that the Australian Aborigine, we've considered them the lowest possible level that humanity could ever reach. They don't build houses. They have only one weapon, that's the boomerang. And they will stand on one leg, you know, balancing themselves with their spear, and their eyes wide open, and flies crawl unmolested across their eyes, and they don't even blink. And we said they were too stupid to, not only too stupid to wear clothes, but too stupid to build houses or protect themselves in any way, or even blink the flies out of their eyes. And yet this woman who had spent 9 years with them and whose health broke and she had come back, we had long conversations. And she said that the truth of the matter is they lived in what they call dream time, which was a world radically different than ours. It bore no resemblance at all and was absolute eternity, that it was the most beautiful, magnificent experience of her life, and that it was disappearing. We're killing it off from the earth itself, which would destroy one of the last ties we have with who we really should have been and what our earth really was. And this ties in with Robert Wolf's book, Original Wisdom, and what he found ties in with everything that I've heard about this Australian Aborigine. And you can't stop there. There have been two or three other examples of this. So we find that what we're doing with the earth extends far beyond just damaging it physically, but we're also changing the entire, what you might say, mental state and all, because we now almost overwhelm the earth with overpopulation. And it's a way of thinking, a way of using the mind, which is extremely destructive. So I will get sounding like a pessimist, but I'm rather pessimistic about the living earth itself. And I'm convinced that the truth behind global warming is that the earth is warming up her temperature simply as an attempt to get rid of an unwanted disease.
Exactly. That's what the body does, isn't it? Brings a fever.
Brings a fever. I think in my talk about this in a paper or somewhere, I talked about when we were in India the last time in 1990, we were coming back in India, and our daughter, who was, I don't know, 7 or 8 months old, developed a terrible fever on the trip, in the New York airport was vomiting all over the place, and just a sky-high fever. And everyone was rushing, trying to give my wife advice, and she just ignored it all and nursed her infant and never stopped nursing her and wouldn't hear any of the things, oh, for a baby's fever, it's very dangerous. Listen, and she said, the child is developing her immunities. And by golly, the fever finally hit a crisis point and then abated, and she was perfectly all right. And ended up, you know, just a very healthy child. My point there is that's what a living plant does. If it develops something, it'll develop a temperature to try to get rid of that which is causing its trouble. And we could look at the living earth going, its temperature going up, and we'll say, oh, it's doing this and it's doing... No. We've mistreated the earth in many of those ways for eons, but it's doing something it's never done before, and it's trying to get rid of, in effect, a cancerous growth, which happens to be us, by developing a higher and higher fever. And we can expect the temperature of the earth to rise quite high, and to most people that would be an absolute ridiculous assumption to make, but it's one of the considerations.
You're in good company here, Joseph.
Well, good.
The phenomena of all of these things is biological norm, and our enculturation is gradually masking it, just as it's getting rid of the Aborigine. The acculturation is, you know, people are always afraid of, oh my gosh, the computer is going to take over and it's going to not run under orders from us anymore. It's going to take its own personality and run things. Well, acculturation has done that. It's succeeded. And that's, you know, that's a big thing to look at.
Oh, I have to agree that looking at this, the book Exploring the Crack, of course, Crack came out in 1970, and this book came out, so it's an old book, and yet I was delighted when they brought it back out, because it picks up where I left off exploring, and that could only go just so far and then no further. And now I wrote I meant just the book itself, The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, could go just so far. And it didn't go into this realm, and that's what this book Exploring did. It picked up where the other left off, and boy, it's got, I just started rereading it again, and it really has some mighty choice spots in it, I must say. And I'm delighted to get it all the attention I can. In fact, I took a few, the new copy is certainly breathtaking too. What ITI did with this is so much more beautiful than any of my books that they have published, and I was so pleased with it. I took a batch up to a friend of mine who owns a bookstore, and I just gave them to her, and I said, I'm so pleased with this book. I said, just give it away as a gift.
Oh, well, and, yeah. Well, I'm going to be on that street corner next to you, only you said you would be out on the street corner handing out Original Wisdom by Robert Wolfe. I'm going to be on the corner handing out your book, Exploring the Crack in the Cosmic Egg. It's just so fantastic. And your ability, Joseph, to write these things is just presents, I think, the depth of a man who, you know, really has not just thought things through, but really come to a beautiful understanding on the other side of things.
Well, I don't know about all that, but I do know that I had itched for a long time, so to speak, to get all this, some of this out of my system. And, back in the 50s, I guess it was, my teaching colleagues, the faculty colleagues of mine in our department, one of them called me and said, you know, I hate to tell you this, but we've drawn the conclusion that you're hopelessly mad. Well, I was delighted to hear that, because I thought had they never recognized that, then I was just, nothing in me had changed at all either. But this stirred me to turn out that first book, and that was, after all, about 1970 before I got it published. So that was a long time ago. And boy, the things that have happened, sometimes I like to think, at least as a result of having written that, but each one I write, the shortcomings of it begin to bother me, and I've got to write another one.
Yes, there's always a continuation of
the
story. You said earlier that you're a little pessimistic about what's going on, and yet one of your chapters in the book is called Guilty Until Proven Dead, and so you have not lost your sense of humor within all of this, certainly.
Well, yeah. I've been thinking here lately about the serious problem we've set up for our young people. I think young people right today are getting an awful shafting. I think they have a rough road to hoe, because their possibilities and all are getting narrower and narrower and narrower, and the demands on them are getting harsher. I think young people, I'm thinking particularly teenagers and young college people, are having a bad time today. And a lot of it is caused by simply this breakdown of communication, and the young people are really suffering that they can't communicate with themselves or each other. And one of the things that struck me is how from almost birth on, the infant and then child spends an enormous amount of time in front of an electronic device. They say the average 6-month-old infant spent 2 hours a day in front of a backlit screen simply by being carried by their mother when the mother's doing computer work, or sitting and put down in front of a television to entertain them in their playpen while they go about doing something else. And all of that constant immersion in an electronic world and denying the access of the care, love, and nurturing of the real world was having a profound effect on our next generation.
With the last part of your book, the chapter is entitled Embracing Despair. And there's so much that goes into the acceptance of our own death, allowing for real life to take place.
There's a lot to be said for that. what I have found literally happening right now, and I think it's to the good, is a great deal of attention to the after-death state. The work of Rudolf Steiner, I think, is incredibly important. He's one of the great geniuses of all times anyway. He gave us Waldorf education, and he gave us this totally radically different way of raising crops in he's given us loads of new ways of looking at the world, Rudolf Steiner has, and we haven't anywhere near explored all of the things he offered. One of the interesting things is that the Waldorf schools, which he set up, which are some of the most magnificent things that can happen to a child, is Waldorf education. And one of the first things the Nazis did in 1932, after they burned the Reichstag, was to get rid of all the Waldorf schools in the country. And they were just really catching on back there in the 20s. And schools were switching over to the Waldorf process right and left because of the wonderful things it could do for children. And here came the Nazis, and there are two things they did: seize the radio and all forms of communication, and the other was get rid of, shut down all Waldorf education. And someone said, why are you closing the Waldorf schools? And he said, because they teach children to think. We want them trained to obey. Oh, boy. And did he manage that one pretty awfully.
Right, and that's certainly going on more and more and more with the schools.
Well, there are aspects of it. In this case, it has to do whether or not we can make the schools fully support our current terribly misappropriating financial situation, taxation laws, and so on that are going on right now, and how this is, as we know, all geared to a very small percentage of the population who are reaping incredible fortunes at the overall cost of a great deal to the populace. And the very same sort of a thing that happened to the Waldorf schools then would be happening on a much wider scale now if they had grown as Rudolf Steiner had There are a lot of people I've found who don't really understand who Steiner was. He died in 1923, I think it was. But he was one of the great geniuses of recent centuries.
Just like Jesus or Buddha or any religious figure or origin of religion, I feel like by the time you move beyond a generation and a half, the misinterpretations start happening. It moves further and further away from the experiential, and then it goes into interpretation, which, of course, is what you're talking about, I think, in Exploring the Crack in the Cosmic Egg.
Oh, indeed. And boy, there you've got a real hot one. I don't really get into the religious issue anymore much at all, simply because it's too hot a potato. And brings up two dramatic contrasts among people. They seem to park their brains when they get into the issue of religion. And I think religion has been a perfectly terrible thing. On the other hand, the book I turned out two or three back was called The Death of Religion and Rebirth of Spirit. And I'm telling you, that's what's going on right now. Religion is dying, thank God, but a real spiritual metamorphosis, just a rebirth is happening on Earth.
Yes.
I'm convinced of that as well.
I love the story about Livingstone that you related. And when he was bitten by the tiger, I think it was a tiger, or when he was in Africa.
Yes.
Could you relate that story?
No, because I can't remember it right off the bat.
Okay. It was a story about how everyone was aghast watching him, and yet he just didn't buy into...
Oh, he went into euphoria.
Yes.
Yes, when the great lion seized him by the shoulder and the teeth of the lion actually met each other, and he was shaking Livingstone, and Livingstone knew his end had come, and he found himself going into the most euphoric, beautiful state. And to me, that was the most wonderful thing I'd ever read. I thought, well, of course, nature doesn't mock her children. She doesn't bring us into this reality without concern over our well-being. And that's what I was referring to with that. And I will say that if in some way in this book I could reinforce that idea that the death of religion should give the rebirth of spirit. And there's a profound difference between religion and spirit. And I think the old particle physics found its place through this religion. Who was it that said that the rise of science as it stands now could have only happened in a Christian country? Very brash argument, which I agree with wholeheartedly.
Another huge difference is, and you speak some about it regarding Don Juan and his teachings to Carlos Castaneda about fear. And there's a difference between fear and fright and panic. And there is a very real difference to those things.
Oh, I think that's one of the most exciting things. I talk about unconflicted behavior a great deal. I've talked about that in several of my books, and anytime I'm asked to give a talk, I will talk about unconflicted behavior. If we can eliminate all conflict within ourselves, it opens up a whole new world. For instance, they are now finding that women who literally practice the going into a state of euphoria and all, and approaching childbirth without fear, but instead with great excitement, and I'll go into a tremendous state, and instead of having birth pangs and pains, they have orgasm, and the thing of the orgasm pleasures them with this incredible euphoric and very beneficial state. And so we find that some of our oldest fears, like the fears of childbirth and so on, bring about their own bad state, and that getting rid of the fear is the major thing. I found that in what I called unconflicted behavior. I found that out in my late teens, and it was really true that getting rid of all conflict inside myself, where with one thing I'm thinking, well, I'll do this, and with the other I'm thinking right and opposite to it, but I'll probably fail, that kind of thing strips us of our real power. I've gone into that quite a bit in my later books, and for good reason, because I've had an awful lot more experience with it.
Yes, and I love that term roof brain chatter.
Yeah, that's, of course, all these places where they're trying to teach meditation just to quiet the brain down. And why do we have all that roof brain chatter? It's mostly worry, fretting, concern, anger, resentment, and so on. And with our radios going full blast with all sorts of negative news, and the TV with negative news, we're hit with negative on every angle. And if we can eliminate all that and within ourselves eliminate the negativity, we'll find that we can do all sorts of things that we couldn't do before. I would say that my book, The Death of Religion and Rebirth of Spirit, goes into this very issue of what has limited us tremendously as a species is our practices of religion. Of course, I better watch out. I'll have a cross burned on my lawn tonight. But there's a huge difference between religion and spirit. And I have said that the greatest, of course, of all of our religious figures ever would be Jesus. And he's the very one who spelled it out. Get rid of the inner conflict, and you could do anything. He said you can leap off the cliff and not be hurt. You can pick up the stone and turn it to bread. All these different things through unconflicted behavior. And getting rid of the conflict in you. And, of course, he's pointing up the way we could do that. I really like that subject very much. We're really going to have to call a halt here to our little conversation. I love it, but I'm getting too hoarse. I must confess that going on 89 now, I don't have the stamina that I used to have.
I want to thank you so much, Joseph. Your writing just gets better and better and so very insightful. And I thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Well, I thank you for the invitation to do so. And I hope I'm around for my 90th birthday. We'll do it again.
All right. That sounds great.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And there we have it. Joseph Chilton Pierce, exploring the crack in the cosmic egg. Thanks for staying tuned.